The presidential motorcade had just passed through heavy crowds in downtown Dallas.
Destroying the media lies and dismantling the narratives. One story at a time. It's the Adrian Slade Show.
Academia, higher academia, universities, we all know that they've become indoctrination centers. We've known that for quite some time. And I love the fact that Mark Levin and Dan Bongino have been calling it the Poison Ivy League. But we may have lost an entire generation due to these re-education camps. I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. We saw last week what happened with the hearing with various colleges that allowed the Jewish anti-Semitism committed by those who support Hamas. So if you break it down, October 7th happened. Hamas invades Israel. Israel hadn't really had a dust up with them for quite a few years, at least 3 years. They had an issue with Iran where they broke in and stole all their intel and then showed it to the world, which was amazing. The Mossad kicked that all off. But it's been kind of quiet between Hamas and Israel. And then October 7th happened and they killed tons of people, invaded a music concert. We all know what happened there. So all of these people in American universities and what have you, they're all standing up going, ceasefire and Israel, death to the Jews and all of this stuff because they're pro-Hamas. How did we get so many universities with so many groups that are all marching at the same time and they're all pro-Hamas? They're all pro-terrorism and they're all pro-anti-Semitism. They're all hating on Jews, which, you know, we all thought, is that possible? I mean, how was World War II, how was Nazi Germany, their rise, and more importantly, the rise of Hitler, how did that happen? Well, we now know because there's this hatred for Jews that is just inherent. And I would go so far to say that it's a very spiritual battle. They hate because Christianity is next on the chopping block. We can get into Christian nationalism that's been thrown around lately, which we may do. I don't know. Let's see how the time goes. But really, the rise in anything that is anti-God is what we're witnessing. And we see that with the transgenderism movement. You know, they're born in the wrong body, so they're rejecting the way God created them. And so they have to mutilate themselves through their newfound religion of science. Science, you know, and Dr. Fauci, who's, you know, he's not a Catholic anymore, but, you know, he doesn't need to be, right? He's figured it out. He's good. He doesn't need to go to church anymore. We can get into that clip too. But the rise of anti-Christian, anti-God, anti-Jewish hatred is something that's now, it's been brewing for quite some time, but it's starting to really, you know, starting to percolate. It's like percolator. And so some of these universities, the deans were brought in, you know, because some of them get federal funding and what have you, and they were brought in to testify before a congressional hearing because they're going, hey, how are you guys allowing this to happen on your campus? You know, Jewish students have to go hide in certain closets on certain campuses because they feel threatened. You can't have Ben Shapiro and Michael Knowles and Steven Crowder show up, even Milo Yiannopoulos back in the day, show up to these colleges and give any sort of speeches on conservative values because they'd have death threats and they would flood the place with violent activists and Antifa-style brown shirts and what have you. So why is that speech okay to be threatened with violence, but, you know, some of the others, some of the stuff on the left, it's okay. We're going to, you know, we're going to allow Hamas to go, pro-Hamas individuals go march through the campus talking about death to the Jews and the Enfanada from the river to the sea, which means, you know, from the Jordan River to the Mediterranean Sea. That means there would be no Israel if you had that mantra come to fruition. So here's a news story kind of giving you a breakdown of what you're about to hear.
Congress has opened an investigation into Harvard, MIT, and the University of Pennsylvania after their presidents faced widespread backlash following their testimony about growing anti-Semitism on their campuses. All three leaders testified before the House Committee on Education and the Workforce on Tuesday and dodged questions on whether the students calling for the genocide of Jews violates their school's code of conduct. In response, the House committee opened an investigation into the three institutions. As its chairwoman, Republican Congresswoman Virginia Fox of North Carolina criticized the schools for failing to tackle the rampant anti-Semitism on their campuses. In addition, the trio are facing calls to resign, as well as the loss of significant funds from donors. According to the Wall Street Journal, hedge fund manager Ross L. Stevens said that he would pull back a donation to Penn worth approximately $100 million absent a change in the school's leadership.
So that's the overview from leftist media. And we need to get into Elise Stefanik. Not my favorite Republican, but, you know, I mean, she does have some bark and bite. I think her voting record's kind of weak, but she does have a good stance, and she fought really hard during the whole Mueller probe. And so now we're seeing this again, where she kind of takes on these deans. Listen to her. She's setting the table here for what's about to come.
Good morning. Thank you for being here today. This is a very important day on the House Education and Workforce Committee. We're about to have an incredibly important hearing addressing the rise of anti-Semitism on our college campuses and universities. Joining us today to share their personal stories, we have four incredibly brave students, Talia, Bella, Eyal, and Jonathan. Jewish students, faculty, and communities at these so-called elite institutions, including my alma mater, Harvard, Jewish students are facing sustained attacks from students and professors who are openly propagandizing terror. And why? Merely because these Jewish students exist. In response, campus leadership has cowered to the woke anti-Semitic mob. This fanaticism against Israel is rooted in ignorance and hatred. Our institutions of higher education are failing our next generation. They are failing Talia, Bella, Eyal, Jonathan, and countless other students. The attacks on October 7th shocked the conscience of the world, marking the deadliest day for the Jewish people since the Holocaust. However, these atrocities were met with callous cruelty at universities across America. At Harvard, 30 radical student organizations disgustingly blamed Israel for the barbaric attacks against innocent Israelis, only for the group's actions to be brazenly defended by Harvard President Claudine Gay as, quote, free expression. Following our remarks today, the students will join my colleagues at the Education and Workforce Committee hearing, where Harvard, MIT, and Penn's leadership will likely defend desperately their indefensible recent actions and the campus culture that has enabled anti-Semitism on their campuses. Any voice who openly defends the massacre of innocents has chosen the side of terrorism. I continue to demand that Harvard President Claudine Gay resign and that Harvard and schools like it are prohibited from collecting taxpayer dollars.
And Elise Stefanik is correct. I mean, this has been the worst massacre to the Jewish community since the Holocaust, which, you know, at the time of this recording was 65 days ago. So, Joe Biden, your thoughts?
It's been 65 years since the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. 65 years. But we know this year's Hanukkah is different. It's been 65 years since the deadliest day of the Jewish people since the Holocaust. 65 years.
Yeah, not 65 years. That would make it 1958, I think. Holocaust was way before that, but who's counting, Joe? So now, Elise Stefanik finally sits down with these individuals, and this is a clip involving University of Pennsylvania's Dean Liz McGill, who resigned, and also Dr. Gay. She is actually the Dean of Harvard, and we're going to get into some interesting new developments with this dean here in just a few minutes. But she gets called out, and both of them dance around the question of, do you support anti-Semitism, or do you support things like, you know, support the empanada and from the river to the sea and death to the Jews? And listen to this back and forth. It's incredible.
At MIT, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate MIT's code of conduct or rules regarding bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
If targeted at individuals, not making public statements.
Yes or no? calling for the genocide of Jews does not constitute bullying and harassment?
I have not heard calling for the genocide for Jews on our campus.
But you've heard chants for Intifada.
I've heard chants, which can be anti-Semitic depending on the context, when calling for the elimination of the Jewish people.
So those would not be according to the MIT's code of conduct or rules?
That would be investigated as harassment, if pervasive and severe.
Ms. McGill, at Penn, does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's rules or code of conduct? Yes or no?
If the speech turns into conduct, it can be harassment. Yes.
I am asking, specifically calling for the genocide of Jews, does that constitute bullying or harassment?
If it is directed and severe or pervasive, it is harassment.
So the answer is yes.
It is a context-dependent decision, Congresswoman.
It's a context-dependent decision. That's your testimony today. Calling for the genocide of Jews is depending upon the context. That is not bullying or harassment. This is the easiest question to answer yes, Ms. McGill. So is your testimony that you will not answer yes?
If it is, if the speech becomes, if the speech becomes conduct, it can be harassment, yes.
Conduct meaning committing the act of genocide? The speech is not harassment? This is unacceptable, Ms. McGill. I'm going to give you one more opportunity for the world to see your answer. Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Penn's code of conduct when it comes to bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
It can be harassment.
The answer is yes. And Dr. Gill's bullying and harassment, yes or no?
It can be, depending on the context.
What's the context?
Targeted as an individual. Targeted as, at an individual.
It's targeted at Jewish students, Jewish individuals. Do you understand your testimony is dehumanizing them? Do you understand that dehumanization is part of antisemitism? I will ask you one more time. Does calling for the genocide of Jews violate Harvard's rules of bullying and harassment? Yes or no?
Anti-Semitic rhetoric. When it
and is it anti-Semitic rhetoric?
Anti-Semitic rhetoric when it crosses into conduct that amounts to bullying, harassment, intimidation, that is actionable conduct, and we do take action.
So the answer is yes, that calling for the genocide of Jews violates Harvard code of conduct, correct?
Again, it depends on the context.
It does not depend on the context. The answer is yes, and this is why you should resign. These are unacceptable answers across the board.
They dance around it left and right. They're constantly avoiding, well, you know, without context and, you know, it's a yes or no answer. It's pretty easy. I don't think anyone, you know, at least a good 10 years ago would have a problem answering that. But the wokeness, the diversity, equity, inclusion, BS that has been pumped into the universities, that has now changed that dynamic. And it's now gotten deans to, you know, funding can be controlled by it. ESG is a part of the DEI, the diversity, equity, inclusion parameters. So all types of access to financial capital can be controlled because you didn't take the right stances. You know, it's all mafia driven BS, to be honest. And that's what we're seeing with the climate. That's what we're seeing with big corporations and why that they put out the ads they do and why they pander to certain groups the way that they do and why they shun Christianity during Christmas season, or they, you know, will push Pride Month so hard. It's because of that. It's because of the access to financial capital and the dog and pony, the dog tricks you have to do, the dog and pony shows you have to put on to get any of that funding to fit under their requirements. You know, it's like having a credit score, but instead of looking at your spending history and your credit capitalization thresholds, and, you know, they're looking at, oh, well, did you take the right stance at the ballot box? Did you take the right stance in the culture war? And so this is what you get. You get deans like this. And then everyone has to rush to their defense. The New York Times puts out this article: as fury erupts over campus anti-Semitism, conservatives seize the moment. They're pouncing and seizing and pouncing. because that's what they do. The conservatives pounced. You know, they got on there and they had a time with it, right? It's unbelievable. And then you get SNL. I watched this in real time because my wife wanted to watch SNL, and I can't stand how bad SNL has gotten lately. So I sat through it, and that opening came on, and I couldn't believe it. They, with all of the comedic gold that was available to them, all the material, all the different angles that they could have made something hilarious, they did a skit where they basically portrayed the deans as these reasonable people, and they, and you can hear the diversity, equity, inclusion angle being flushed into the personality of the deans that they're portraying, these comedians or so-called comedians. And they just make Elise Stefanik just look like a bimbo dingbat. I mean, listen to this. It's the most humorless thing I've ever seen on SNL.
But first, testimony from three university presidents on the subject of anti-Semitism on college campuses.
Order, please. Thank you. We're joined today by the heads of three of our most esteemed universities, the president of MIT, Sally Kornbluth.
I've never been more afraid to be anywhere.
The president of UPenn, Elizabeth McGill.
Can I just resign now?
Not yet. And the president of Harvard, Dr. Claudine Gay.
Thank you.
Dr. Gay, would you like to do a quick joke about your name to get it out of the way?
I would. Dr. Gay sounds like a Molly dealer on Fire Island.
Thank you. Now, I'll turn it over to mega superstar Elise Stefanik from New York, who's been pacing the hallways listening to Lose Yourself by Eminem. Miss Stefanik.
Thank you, Chairwoman. Now, I'm going to start screaming questions at these women like I'm Billy Eichner. Anti-Semitism, yay or nay?
I'm sorry, what?
Yes, Arno is calling for the genocide of Jews against the code of conduct for Harvard.
Well, it depends on the context.
What? That can't be your answer, you pen lady. Same question, yes or no?
Well, we are serious about stopping all forms of hatred, anti-Semitism, Islamophobia.
And then that the second one, MIT lady, chance to steal. And keep in mind, if you don't say yes, you're going to make me look good, which is really, really hard to do. So I'll ask you straight up. Do you think genocide is bad?
Could I submit an answer in writing at a later date?
Am I winning this hearing? Somebody pinch me.
I mean, it was really weak. And I love the Babylon Bee. You got to love these guys. They came in with two really good articles about the SNL cold opening that was lame. Powerful. SNL makes unfunny sketch to show that anti-Semitism is no laughing matter. Your one job is to be funny. And you can't even commit to that because the narrative has to be upheld. And I love this here. How about this? Well, we'll get into this one. Hang on. I got to hold this one off because it kind of goes to a bigger point that we're about to step into. But, yeah, Claudine Gay from Harvard made to look like she's some reasonable person on SNL. And they've got Liz McGill. They at least acknowledged that she was fired or stepped down, you know, hours before the program went to live air. But they just totally blew an opportunity. I mean, and it's funny because not to go off on a tangent here, but as far as SNL goes, you know, they try to pretend like they're this political Charlie Hebdo attack group. I'm going to attack the right. Yeah, we're going to get them. And it's just basically a therapy session on a Saturday night for leftists. I mean, SNL is the only, quote, comedy show that can take the congressional hearing of three university deans who can't denounce death to the Jews as anti-Semitism and spend the entire time just mocking Elise Stefanik. And then they throw a little Trump jab in there. I mean, it was freaking lame. It was really weak. And they basically took up for the deans by portraying them as some arbiters of diversity, equity, inclusion. They left all that comedic possibility, all on the cutting room floor and simply just mock the Republican as being a ditzy buffoon. But unfortunately, you know, my wife made me sit through it. And, you know, it was just a pathetic piece of poo. And then they, you know, they have to find a way to throw in the gay comedian all the time because, you know, they got to stick it in the face of those Christians, you know. Then they go further down. They ridiculed Christians during the episode about, you know, there was a nativity scene with like all of the, you know, the shepherds and the sheep and everybody involved in the nativity all colored in American flag colors. It was really weak. I mean, it's just, but you know, they're going to get wasted afterwards and they're all going to high five each other in their little liberal bubble while you wasted your Saturday night watching this garbage. I mean, take me back to the days of Eddie Murphy and, you know, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd and, you know, John Candy and Jim Belushi. I mean, take me back to Phil Hartman, Adam Sandler, Chris Farley, David Spade, Mike Myers. You know, I mean, take me to those days. Dana Carvey, you know? Even take me back to, well, Rob Schneider. I mean, throw him in there, too. He's been making a good comeback. I mean, take me back even to Will Ferrell and Chris Kattan and, you know, Sherry O'Terry. But, I mean, this crap is just complete garbage. And so we have the left putting out media articles saying we're pouncing in season. You got SNL up there trying to make the Republicans look really bad. But we're starting to find out that there's some bigger issues at hand with what's going on, especially with Claudette, what's her name? Claudine Gay, the dean of Harvard. And a couple things to remember about Harvard here. One of the biggest impetuses for the lockdowns to happen during the COVID freakout back in March 2020 was when Harvard sent their kids home. Now, people will say, well, yeah, the NBA shut down and this and that. These other companies were shutting down. The main thing was, and I heard interviews with the governor of Arizona. I heard interviews, or it might have been New Mexico. Various individuals specifically say, well, when Harvard shut their doors and sent their kids home, that's when we knew we had to make the policy decision to close our state. Harvard. The other thing to remember about Harvard is there was a guy who had an island with underage girls on it. Big old pedophile. Well, guess what? He was in bed with Harvard, too. So I think Les Wexner, too, from the Victoria's Secret fame, who was being managed, or at least his finances, by Jeffrey Epstein, had some connections with Harvard as well. So Harvard is not just being an educational outfit. I think they even had something to do with some of the studying of the Wuhan coronavirus. You know, I can't remember off the top of my head, but Harvard has had its hands in various certain things. So it wouldn't surprise me that they would spend all their time trying to build an indoctrination center. And they would look over some amazing things like Chris Rufo. He is a journalist. He debunks all types of woke ideology being pushed in education, whether it be in colleges, whether it be in, you know, K through 12. He's also on the board of a Florida college that Ron DeSantis has been remaking, pulling out the former deans and professors and restructuring it into being Florida's answer to Hillsdale College. Put Chris Rufo on the board. He said he's got an example of some things coming down the pike here from Claudine Gay. So Christopher Rufo put out this memo that Claudine Gay put out to the Harvard faculty. And it was to the faculty and the arts and science department when she was dean. And it flies in the face of everything she said to Elise Stefanik and the world. This memo was written when she was shortlisted as a candidate for the Harvard presidency. We must face a stunning possibility. Gay got the job precisely because she holds these views. The memo not only exposes her hypocrisy and duplicity, but it also is the real source of what makes her and those like her the most destructive force in American higher education. This memo is a blueprint for the intellectual corruption and politicization of a once great institution, and it laid the groundwork for the anti-Semitism and the anti-Americanism rampant in Harvard's campuses today. This is Gay's agenda for Harvard, which means for the rest of American higher education as well. Gay obviously should be fired, but that's not enough. Her ideological agenda must be opposed and tossed into the dustbin of history. Here's what she said, dear members of the FAS community. As we look ahead to the start of a fall semester unlike any other, of course, this is during COVID 2020, we confront the realization that we are now living history in the making. The moment has been shaped by cries of old and new as one pandemic has collided with another. The COVID-19 pandemic is a truly singular event, a public health threat that has spared no part of our academic enterprise from disruption, forcing us to reimagine everything from undergraduate residential life to the daily activities of our labs and libraries. Meanwhile, a second pandemic is unfolding, one with deeper roots in American life. People across the world have risen up in protest against police brutality and systemic racism, awake to the devastating legacies of slavery and white supremacy like never before. The calls for racial justice heard on our streets are also on our campus as we reckon with our individual and institutional shortcomings and with our faculty's shared responsibility to bring truth to bear on the pernicious effects of structural inequality. Even as our opportunities to be together on campus are limited, now is the time to re-engage and reconnect both with each other and with the promise of our mission to advance knowledge and discovery in the service of a more just world. This moment offers a profound opportunity for institutional change that should not and cannot be squandered. The national conversation around racial equality and equity continues to gain momentum at unprecedented rates of mobilization, and the demand for justice gives me hope. In raw, candid conversations and virtual gatherings covered across the FAS in the aftermath of George Floyd's brutal murder, members of our community spoke forcefully and with searing clarity about the institution we aspire to be and the links we still must travel to be the Harvard of our ideals. It is up to us to ensure that the pain expressed, the promises identified, and the solutions suggested set us on a path for a long-term change. I write today to share my personal commitment to this transformational project and to the first steps the FAS will take to advance this important agenda in the coming year. I mean, she goes on and on about, you know, this fall we will reactivate the cluster higher in ethnicity, indigenacy, and migration with the goal of making four new faculty appointments. These appointments are critical to our long-term efforts to strengthen our research and teaching capacity. I mean, she's obviously redoing Harvard University as the new dean. And, you know, everyone's saying, well, you know, there's no racial issues going on. No one's pushing diversity, equity, inclusion. Here's this one person from Dartmouth University. Her name is Rizam Ropika. She's a professor. And she said, what's important to know about the efforts to take down university presidents is that the gentle right-wingers involved see this as a point of entry to dismantle DEI initiatives. Well, here's what she actually wrote. This is back in 2020, in July of 2020. Reopening schools safely can't happen without racial equity. It's unbelievable, these people. Well, so while she was on her quest to reimagine Harvard, she was doing so by plagiarizing tons of people. From Christopher Rufo's Substack, is Claudine Gay a plagiarist? It's It's amazing. These people are just shameless in all things. Harvard President Claudine Gay has problems. Touted as the first black woman to run the nation's most prestigious university, she assumed leadership with high expectations, but her tenure, which began this summer, has been mired in scandal. As dean and then president, Gay has been accused of bullying colleagues, suppressing free speech, overseeing a racist admissions program, and following the Hamas terrorist campaign in Israel, failing to stand up to rampant anti-Semitism on campus. Now, we have obtained exclusive documentation demonstrating that President Gay may face yet another problem, plagiarism of sections of her PhD dissertation, which would violate Harvard's own stated policies on academic integrity. Quote, we reached out to President Gay for comment, but no response. Gay published her dissertation, Taking Charge, Black Electoral Success, and the Redefinition of American Policies in 1997 as part of her doctorate in political science from Harvard. The paper deals with white, black political representation and racial attitudes. As evaluated under the university's plagiarism policy, the paper contains at least three problematic patterns of usage and citation. First, Gay lifts an entire paragraph, nearly verbatim, from Lawrence Bobo and Franklin Gilliam's paper, Race, Sociopolitical Participation, and Black Empowerment, while passing it off as her own paraphrase and language. Here is the original from Bobo and Gilliam. Quote, using 1987 National Sample Survey data, the results show that blacks in high black empowerment areas, as indicated by control of the mayor's office, are more active than either blacks living in low empowerment areas or their white counterparts of comparable socioeconomic status. Furthermore, the results show that empowerment influences black participation by contributing to a more trusting and efficacious orientation to politics and by greatly increasing black attentiveness to political affairs. And now, here is the language from Gay's work. Using 1987 survey data, Bobo and Gilliam found that of African Americans in, quote, high black empowerment areas, as indicated by control of the mayor's office, are more active than either in areas or their white counterparts of comparable socioeconomic status, empowerment, they conclude, influences black participation by contributing to a more trusting and efficacious orientation towards politics and by greatly increasing black attentiveness to political affairs. Though Gay does provide a reference to the original authors, she uses their verbatim language with a few trivial synonym substitutions without providing quotation marks. This constitutes a clear violation of Harvard's policy, which states, quote, when you paraphrase, your task is to distill the source's ideas in your own words. It's not enough to change a few words here and there and leave the rest. Instead, you must completely restate the ideas in the passage in your own words. If your own language is too close to the original, then you are plagiarizing. And even if you do provide a citation, I know, you know, critics of Rufo and those on the left, they would read that and go, see, these guys are nitpicking. She just messed up, you know, and didn't put this in there. This is how she got her PhD. This is not something you just gloss over, because these are the things that would be scrutinized by those who are in the program to discern between who is eligible for a sought-after PhD. Many of these PhD programs only take like 7 candidates a year or a school, you know, year. So, I mean, it's kind of important to what she is doing as far as now being the president of Harvard University. Gay repeats this violation throughout the document, again using the work from Bobo and Gilliam, as well as passages from Richard Shingles, Susan Howe, and Deborah Fagan, which she reproduces nearly verbatim without quotation marks. Second, Gay appears to lift a material from scholar Carol Swan in at least two instances, in one passage summarizing the distinction between descriptive representation and substantive representation. She copies the phrasing and the language nearly verbatim from Swain's book, Black Faces, Black Interest, without providing citations of any kind. Gay's version is... Let's read Swain's version first. I didn't think that this would be something that can be laid out audio-wise, but I think I can. Pitkin distinguishes between, quote, descriptive representation, the statistical correspondence of the demographic characteristics, and more substantive representation, the correspondence between the representatives' goals and those of their constituents. Gay's version is virtually the same with slight modifications to the diction and punctuation. This is Gay's version. Social scientists have concentrated between descriptive representation, parentheses, the statistical correspondence of demographic characteristics, and substantive representation, parentheses, the correspondence of legislative goals and priorities. Gay's use of Swain's material is a straightforward violation of the university's rule on verbatim plagiarism, which states that one must give credit to the author of the source material either by placing the source material in quotation marks and providing a clear citation, or by paraphrasing the source material and providing a clear citation, neither of which Gay followed. So I can go on with this article. There's quite a few things in here, but this is an example of why we have individuals in power and in influential places of institutions that are corrupt and are corrupting those that they're bringing up. And it goes even further, because there was another individual by the name of Aaron Sabarium, and this individual wrote, Scoop, Rufo's examples are just the tip of the iceberg. In four articles published between 1993 and 2017, including her dissertation, Gay paraphrased or quoted almost 20 authors without proper attribution, in some cases lifting entire paragraphs verbatim. This is the lady that wants to change Harvard into a diversity, equity, inclusion petri dish so that she can destroy another generation. And we will have more people protesting for Hamas and protesting for George Floyd by burning down auto zones. From Aaron's tweet thread, we worked with nearly a dozen scholars to analyze 29 potential cases of plagiarism. Most of them said Gay had indicated or had violated a core principle of academic integrity, plus Harvard's own anti-plagiarism policies, which state that, quote, it's not enough to change a few words here and there. Rather, scholars are expected to cite the sources of their work, including when paraphrasing, and to use quotation marks when quoting directly from others. But in at least 10 instances, Gay lifted full sentences, even entire paragraphs, with just a word or two tweaked. In their 1997 thesis, for example, she borrowed a full paragraph from a paper by scholars Bradley Palinquist, then a political science professor at Harvard, and Stephen Voss, one of Gay's classmates, in her PhD program in Harvard while making only a couple alterations. Unbelievable. So let's see here. The example that we have, this is the original version from Bradley Palminquist and Stephen Voss. Quote, the average turnout rate seems to decrease linearly, as African Americans become a larger proportion of the population. This is one sign that the data contain little aggregation bias. If racial turnout rates change depending upon a precinct's racial mix, which is one description of bias, a linear form would be unlikely to in a simple scatter plot, resulting only when changes in one's race turnout rate somehow compensated for changes in the authors or the others across the graph. So then this is what she wrote, Claudine Gray. Quote, the average turnout rate seems to increase linearly as African Americans become a larger proportion of the population. This is one side that the data contain little aggregation bias. If the racial turnout rates change dependent upon a precinct's racial mix, which is one of one way to think about bias in a linear form, would be unlikely to in a simple scatter plot. A linear form would only result if the changes in one race's turnout were compensated by changes in the turnout of the other race across the graph. So she took like maybe three extra phrases and stuffed them in the middle of the original paragraph and didn't really cite it the proper way. The four papers include that plagiarized material comprised a sizable proportion of Gay's academic work. Gay, who is Harvard's 30th president, has authored just 11 peer-reviewed journal articles. Quote, if this were a standalone instance, it would be reprehensible, but perhaps excused as a blunder of someone working hastily, said Peter Wood, a former associate provost of Boston University, where he helped investigate several cases of suspected plagiarism. Quote, but that excuse vanishes as the examples multiply, said Wood, who now serves as the director of National Association of Scholars. Some of the most clear-cut cases come in Gay's 1997 dissertation, quote, Taking Charge, Black Electoral Success in the Redefinition of American Politics, which copied two paragraphs almost verbatim from Plumequist and Voss. Quote, this is definitely plagiarism, says Lee Jussum, a social psychologist at Rutgers University, who reviewed 10 side-by-side comparisons provided by the Free Beacon, including the paragraphs from Gay's dissertation, which received a prize from Harvard for exceptional merit. It's amazing. Quote, the longer passages are almost egregious, he added. Academics say the pattern raises serious questions about Gay's scholarly integrity and about her fitness to lead the nation's oldest university, which has been at the center of a political firestorm under her watch. Donors, alumni, over 70 congressmen have called for Gray to resign in the wake of her disastrous congressional testimony. University of Pennsylvania President Liz McGill, who testified alongside Gay, tendered her resignation on Saturday. Quote, the question here is whether the president of an elite institution such as Harvard can feasibly have an academic record this marred by obvious plagiarism, says Alexander Riley, a sociologist at Bucknell University. Amazing. Quote, I do not see how Harvard could possibly justify keeping her in that position in light of this evidence. Other cases of near verbatim quotation occur in two peer-to-peer reviewed journal articles from 2017 to 2012 when Gay was a tenured professor at Harvard, as well as in an essay she published 1 year out of college in 1993. Quote, it seems that Gay has a habit of using others' words in ways that violated Harvard's policies, quote, a professor at a top research university who received his PhD from Harvard's government department said, quote, and several examples would land any student in serious trouble. It's just ridiculous. These people, in a section called Suggestions for Further Reading, Gay does include Andrew's 1991 book, Blacks and Whites in Sao Paulo, Brazil, from 1888 to 1988, but not in this 1992 paper, quote, Black Political Protest in Sao Paulo, 1888 to 1988, from which the offering text was drawn. So now the text says, George reads Andrew's version of the text, quote, a younger generation of Afro-Brazilians, many of which one or more years of the university study, were starting to organize a new black movement in response to the economic and political exclusion which they were experiencing under the dictatorship. This movement most vividly symbolized by the Movimento Negro Unificado created by in São Paulo in 1978. This new movement of the 1970s and 1980s was, to a large degree, an expression of frustration among upwardly mobile Afro-Brazilians denied admission to the middle-class status to which their education and qualifications entitled them. Now, this is hers, Claudine Gay. It was a younger generation of Afro-Brazilians, many of which who one or more years of the university education, that were among the first and most eager respondents to the MNU's organizational call. Their eagerness was in large part a measure of the economic and political exclusion they had suffered under the military dictatorship. As their numbers grew, it was their aspirations and rhetoric which come to define the organization. The movement became an expression of frustration among the upwardly mobile Afro-Brazilians denied admission to the middle-class status to which their education and qualifications entitled them. The 1993 essay, quote, concerns me less, Riley said, given how early it was in Gay's career. However, it shows a quantity of plagiarism so egregious that minimally, Dr. Gay should stop putting it in her CV. The two-tiered, the two-peered reviewed programs, by contrast, are much more serious, Riley said. It's incredible. This person is leading up Harvard. I mean, one of the most prestigious universities in the world. And the reason why this makes a difference is because they're the ones churning out the leaders that are running these corporations. Now, of course, she responded yesterday with a statement saying Harvard president Claudine Gay responds to the plagiarism scandal by telling the Boston Globe that she, quote, stands by the integrity of her scholarship. Note that she does not specifically deny the allegation of plagiarism, nor explain repeated violations of Harvard's own written academic integrity policies. Bottom line is, Gay's work clearly violates Harvard's own standards. This scandal is not going away. And see, what this is an example of two things. This is an example of double down culture, double down on you know, shamelessness. This stems from the Clinton administration when, you know, he gets a BJ and, you know, back in the day, any sort of thing like Gary Hart having a woman sit on his lap on a yacht. These things would have torpedoed your political aspirations. You would have been done. But Bill Clinton said, to heck with it. Ride it out, double down, and stand firm on the lies, stand firm on the shamelessness and the lack of ethics. Just stand firm on it, and then weather the storm, and on the other side, you'll be okay. And we've seen this a lot in various different sectors. But this is the problem. She's in a position to mold and shape leaders that will go on to run industries that will have no fidelity to the United States, that will want to compromise our sovereignty for new markets in China, which allow intellectual theft, which allows for slave labor of manufacturing. All of these things are what we get when we get pro-Hamas people that want to push pro-Hamas rallies and protests because of diversity, equity, inclusion, taking Hamas and those in the Gaza Strip and trying to shove them into the round hole of racism in America and trying to liken it to George Floyd. The leader of Hamas was actually on video talking about how America cannot speak to what's going on between Israel and Hamas because of George Floyd. What does he have to do with George Floyd? But it's because of diversity, equity, inclusion. It is critical theory. Critical race theory stems from critical theory, which is a communist, Marxist ideological framework that has been put into these universities, and they're pumping out individuals like we're seeing with degrees now. And now we're facing the consequences of multinational corporations siding with George Floyd and siding with Hamas and boycotting, divesting, and what was it, BDS? Boycott, divestment, sanction with Israel. The squad pushes this stuff. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Ayanna Pressley and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. And Rashida Tlaib is an agent of Hamas, backed and funded by Hamas. I mean, we need to start getting serious about what we think is American and what isn't, because we're getting chipped away from every angle by communist and Islamist, which are, and communist China's framework of the Mao Cultural Revolution being instilled with TikTok and everything else under the sun. This is why I wanted to do this podcast. I mean, yeah, I could sit here and go, okay, she got grilled because she wanted to dance around the terrorist Hamas question, and she's been plagiarizing stuff, whoop-de-doo. But no, this is a cog in the wheel of the bigger wheel of problems that we're witnessing. And I was going to get into Christian nationalism. I even want to get into a podcast down the road of this whole movement within the GOP of the gay GOP influencers and journalists and what have you that are into surrogacy, and how this is becoming a big topic. And it's one of the things we need to start looking at as far as what is considered a big tent. Do we need a big coalition? A big tent may not be the greatest thing that we think it is. We welcome everybody, but do they accept our values, or are we pushing our values on them and alienating them? It's a crazy thing I was thinking about over the last couple of weeks, seeing the discussions online, but I felt like we really need to touch base on what's going on in academia again, because it was blown wide open last week, and it's getting even deeper with the background of the individuals pushing all of these ideologies in higher education. I'm Adrian Slade. Thanks for tuning in. Check out the podcast, iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, Google Play, Spreaker. Tune in. Spreaker's gone. Never mind. Oh, no, Stitcher's gone. You can follow me online at Adrian Slade Show on Twitter, or X, it's called now. You can find me on Getter, Gab, Truth Social, on all the socials. Until next time, God bless.